Hey, all, if you'd like to support this show because you like it and you love us and we're so cute and adorable, or because you're somehow sadistic and this is an evil plot of yours to support us and then, like, backstab us later, whichever, you can easily do that by going to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanny, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, you get a free audiobook out of the deal, and you help the show, which means at some point we get to actually buy, you know, like, new clothes and food. So, thanks for listening, hope you enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But to Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 114.
Forcing unsuspecting writers to write stories that feature our inevitable trip to accept a Hugo Award.
Yeah, because that... Wow, Jen, thank you. Thank you. I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today's special guest is Kat Rambo. Welcome to our pathetic little show.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here on this soon-to-be Hugo Award-winning show.
Oh my gosh. Now we're like layering on the expectations. Like, we're totally screwed now.
It might only be in the A story that we win a Hugo Award, but that would be just as epic.
To be totally honest, though, if Kat Rambo wrote that story and we want a Hugo in a story, I count that as a Hugo.
Exactly. It's a win-win.
So if we don't get like one of those rockets or something after that, I'll be really upset.
I'm sure.
So
I'm making a note.
So Kat is on our show to actually talk about her new collection called Near and Far, Stories of the Near Future and the Far Future, which is... basically a collection of really awesome stuff. That's how I would describe it. That should just be the description on the back of the book. A collection of awesome stuff written by Kat Rambo.
It works for me.
Yeah. Of course, it's far more complicated than that. But it's a very interesting collection, and you wanted to be on our awesome show, and we wanted to have you, and I was so excited when I was like, oh my gosh, cool short stories, yes! And then I realized, oh my gosh, I have no idea how to interview an author about short stories.
Because we haven't had to do this before, so no,
this is a first. So it should be very interesting. But first thing I wanted to do is, because we've never had you on the show before, and it's the big question we have to ask all new people on our show, which is, what drew you into writing, and why did you want to write genre fiction as opposed to, I don't know, like trashy romance novels?
Well, it was always assumed in my family that I would write. My grandmother was a young adult writer. And for some reason, because I was the oldest grandchild, she opted that I would inherit her writerly crown. And so she bought me a typewriter and bought me all the books that I ever wanted. And luckily, I love to read and like to write, so it was a natural fit. And why genre? Because I love genre. I was one of those kids that played D&D all through high school. And
another one.
Yeah. Drew endless maps of fantasy worlds. And then I'm also a gamer, and so one of the things about gaming is often your storytelling, so I fell into it.
If only those were the only requirements to becoming a successful writer,
just
I might
gaming.
Be doing pretty well right now. Well, you know, love of reading, drawing endless maps, D&D, I did all those things.
You still do a lot of those things.
I still do those things. And I found that many of our writers that come on are still gamers, you know. They
didn't
grow out of it once they left high school or whatnot, or college, as the case may be. But
yeah.
The muscles.
It is a really big thing in our community that so many of our writers play RPGs, particularly. I mean, you look at, like, we've had Mike Cole on. He did that big game... Wasn't it like a D&D game that he did at one of the conventions with, like...
Was it Confusion?
Yeah, with, like,
I wanted him to include me this year. It was so awesome. They had all sorts of wonderful people, and it sounded like a hoot.
And it's incredible that that is still such a big thing for this community. I mean, it's I think because you would think, you know, all of these writers, most of them go off and they have to get, you know, real jobs, and usually are not exciting real jobs. It's like, you know, they work as an accountant, which I would personally want to not live anymore, but they do it, and then they go on, they become, you know, these big writers, but they're also still total geeks, and
right.
I love it. It's something that's interesting. Like, it also is nice about the community that it's a community in which we never have to give those things up to be, you know, like that's something like you could still be playing those things. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but
no, absolutely. And I think, you know, actually writers have to embrace all of that because, you know, you're writing for people. So you want to know what it is that people really like, and you're a person too. So presumably you're enjoying it. So,
and let's be honest, genre readers are kind of geeky.
Well, we all are. We all, but I mean, that's one of the nice things about like the conventions is you can go to con and you can sit down in a hallway next to someone you've never met before, and they're reading a book and you start talking about it. And it's just, you know, you've kind of fallen in among your tribe.
Oh, for sure.
Except when it's me, because it's authors who I respect, and then I'm like terrified to talk to them. Yeah, Jen has had to save me. Oh my gosh, that was so pathetic.
It's okay, though. Okay, so continuing along, we're going to get to the rest of the questions, because we do have like 8 of them at least, and they tend to take a while. So your introduction to Nier mentions that this book, at least the physical form, which we didn't get, and I'm kind of sad about that because I would have loved to see all the pictures, but you talk about how the physical form is what you believe physical will allow physical books to survive, essentially. Yes. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the somewhat unique form that Near and Far takes?
Absolutely. I love electronic publishing. My husband got me a Kindle a couple years back, and I adore the fact that I can drop 1,000 books on it. And I think that electronic publishing is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I think that physical books will survive, but the ones that survive are going to be the ones that become more than just a mechanism for delivering text. They have to sort of be objects worth acquiring in and of themselves. And so what we did with this book, and I will say I think this is just the most gorgeous book ever, in my completely unbiased opinion, but we took the old ACE double format. And so because the stories fell naturally into two groups, near future and far future, we took the ACE double format, and on one side are the near future short stories, and then you flip it over and you've got the far future stories. And one of the things that I think is really cool is Todd McCoy, who designed the cover, went and looked at a lot of the old ACE doubles and tried to adopt some of the design elements. So it manages to be sort of reminiscent of those old books without looking too retro. Although someone at Worldcon suggested to me the thing that would have made it perfect is if we'd had a cigarette ad or science fiction book club ad right in the middle of the book, and I really wish we'd thought of that.
That would have been hilarious. I think it's kind of interesting, you know, the fact that it does take this very retro form for a collection of short stories that deal with the future.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, if you're going back to when these things were contemporary, they still contain things that were about the future too. But mm-hmm. I think there's a certain, not disconnect, but disparity between those two things that, mm-hmm. that makes it even more valuable as a physical form. Mm-hmm.
It's something that just kind of jumped out when you had mentioned, by the way, and I think this is amusing, the idea that, you know, in the original format you would have included the cigarette ads. I feel like if you ever do a project like this again where you kind of steal from that kind of format, mm-hmm. instead of having an actual cigarette ad, you could have somebody create like a slightly updated futuristic version of one of those ads, but that follows that classic format. That would be so much, like, instead of, you know, cigarettes, it would be like your Soma cigarettes or something.
That's it.
Oh my gosh, that would be so, like, somebody would look at it and they'd go, well, I've never heard of this brand before. And then, you know, but make it so real, like, look like it's, you know, it's got to be the cowboy guy who's like standing by the ranch with the big horse, and You know, he's.
We are thinking about a hardcover version, so these ideas could still get incorporated.
That would be amazing. So, question: so which came first, the chicken or the egg of sorts? Was it the Ace Double format or the idea for the collection?
The idea for the collection. I was actually going to do it as a electronic only version, but then when I talked to Hydra House, they suggested doing the print version, and we ended up kind of it morphed along the way.
And yeah, then it's a really
Ace Double idea. So. And then found it at a dealer's table 2 weeks later. It was like, oh, God damn it, somebody's already thought of this.
I think it would be really interesting as a hardcover edition, only because, as you said, that whole idea of you know, something worth having, especially in a day where people seem to be paring down their belongings as it is and shifting everything to the electronic formats. The ones that you keep, you really want to have a very high quality, interesting item that you, it's much as I hate to say it, you can throw on the coffee table and people will pick it up and be like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Oh,
and
sure.
You've incorporated artwork in order to do that. And I wonder, in some senses, you know, it's like how much popularity things like graphic novels will take if that is kind of the way of the physical book.
Yeah, I think because I read graphic novels on the iPad and they're nice, but they're not as nice. I mean, I think those end up being much more pleasant when you've got them in physical form.
Yeah.
Well, there's something about artwork that just doesn't quite translate well enough to.
Yeah,
there's something sort of like, even though we realize when we read in like a graphic novel or like a comic book, we realize that the page is, it's not the original, it's still a reprint, but there's still something like physically tangible that is there when you're reading a real graphic novel, like a physical form, that you don't get with the, and I think that's somewhat different than even with regular like novels. I mean, sometimes you get that, like people love the physical form, but I think with comics and with those kinds of visual art elements, there is something like about that physical form that makes it so much better than what you might get digitally. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that is, but I just feel that's how I feel. We're talking about feelings right now, so dig deep down, Kat Rambo. How do you feel about physical graphic novels?
I feel good.
I think it's a very visceral experience, you know, to the ebooks. And I'm a big fan of ebooks myself, just because, as you said, you can throw 1,000 books down and wherever you go, you have it. But I still actually tend towards the physical copies of them.
Yeah. Although, to be totally fair, like I the thing that I really love about the ebooks, and it's similar, but in that I can get access to all kinds of old literature that might be really prohibitive for me to get access to just from the cost of buying physical books. So, and that's something that I really like, is all of this out of copyright stuff, and even sometimes really obscure, like old science fiction novels, like before the 40s and 30s. Like, you know, you get these old that you've never even heard of, and you're like, this is so exciting. It's like new experiences now. And it's because of ebooks that it was easy for us to get that.
Yeah.
Because before, I mean, half the stuff wasn't even published, you know, so.
No, you'd have to hunt hard for it.
Yeah, and now with ebooks, we don't have to worry. And I think, I'm an academic, so this is, the ebook revolution for me is also really interesting, precisely because that also follows in the line of digital humanities, in which people are digitizing all kinds of stuff. That has completely changed my field of literary studies, because now we're getting access to all kinds of materials that you'd have to go spend, you know, weeks digging in an archive to get.
Right.
And now it's all online. It's at your fingertips, as they say. So it's good. But, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry. That just reminded me of one of her stories. The idea of digitizing everything and then being able to download it. The memories of moments bright as falling stars.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, talks about the sort of class disparity. But if you have access to a place to put it, the memory hardware, then all you have to do is download it in order to get a job, which I thought was fascinatingly hilarious. I was like, wow, that sounds so convenient.
Well, except that in that story, we still have the disparities between who is most likely to get the jobs. Is it's often the people who can buy the best implants. Mm-hmm. So particularly with the exam, when they go to the exam and they're talking about like things they've had embedded in their legs and all of this like weird, which is also kind of amusing in its kind of macabre way. But yeah, it's just that I particularly like that story because of the way it plays with how data and how we engage with data is going to change or possibly might change as one possibility. It's also kind of creepy, but
kind of cool.
Yeah, except for like, I don't know if I would embed anything in my leg. That's just weird. But
how could you not? I've been dreaming of that since I was about 8.
Look, I like my legs. They're nice legs, and I don't want to mess them up, you know?
Funny.
Just saying. Yeah, that's gross. Anyway, we should not talk about... but actually, let's dive into the story. We're kind of like wandering around other kinds of little issues, but let's actually dive into that particular story because I have a question about your interest in, I guess, cyberspace, memory, data. I mean, you have just a couple of the stories. You know, you have Johnny from Memories of Moments, Brightest Falling Stars, who... lives in a world in which memories, he effectively is like recording his memories at one point in the story, but also there's information which is being transferred, and then you end up have something like Therapy Buddha, in which the main character from that is actually using like crowdsourcing data to sell to corporations, similar to how we would do it now, but it's more like he has like an enclave of like there are 4,500 people in this group and I send them stuff and they do it. And then there's kind of an irony at the end, which I won't ruin because bad stuff happens. And then even something like 10 metaphors for cyberspace, which is very different from all the other stories. And it's trying to give us these different views of how cyberspace might be conceived. And so I'm interested. These are all somewhat identified, I think, to some extent with the cyberpunk tradition. And I was wondering, do you think of yourself as a cyberpunk writer, or do you find something else compelling about these kind of technological explorations beyond the kind of potential for punking?
That's a really good question. And I was recently on a panel about cyberpunk, and one of the things that was mentioned then was that cyberpunk usually refers to a very specific moment in time. And so that we don't really sort of have, you know, Bruce Sterling and Patigan and all those kind of folks writing at the same time. But that said, I think I consider myself at least a post-cyberpunk writer. I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by the ideas of interface and how we interact with data and how we interact with technology and what are the mechanisms by which we do so and how does it change us to be interacting with it. So I think all of those stories are certainly deeply influenced by the cyberpunk writers and their ideas. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that does make a lot of sense. So what is it that for you is, I mean, why are you interested in these? That's such a silly way to place it. But I'm trying to think of like the really intelligent way to ask this question. But really it just comes down to what compels you to write about these kinds of issues like data, mining, memory, the way you've written about it in these particular stories. And what compels you to these things?
Well, and there's two answers to that. And one is that I have a background in network security and working for Microsoft. And I'm very, very interested in computers. I'm very interested in how they change us and how we change them and how we interact with data and kind of what's the coming thing. Partially as just from a practical point of view, because as somebody interacting in today's world, I kind of want to know what's up and what I need to watch out for. But the second answer is that I don't know how anybody could not be fascinated by the extreme coolness of the moment that we're living in. And I think in many ways it's a shitty world, but in a lot of other ways, this is just so freaking cool. I mean, the fact that I can be at my computer and talking to you a long ways away, you know, the fact that, you know, they're just, that people can grow. I don't know if you saw a few years ago, they grew somebody's a new eye and they did it from his tooth. You know, that the fact that you've got three-dimensional printers that can print out skin. I mean, it's just, oh, my God.
Wait, sorry. Can you go back to that? There was an eye grown?
Oh, yeah. They replaced this guy's eye, and they did it. They grew it from his own cells. But the cells that they got came from a tooth of his.
That's kind of
I think it's just so bizarre. Isn't that a great image somehow?
Is it a functioning eye?
Yes. Yes.
Like you can see out of it.
I'm blind to my left eye, so I'm a little bit obsessed with eyes, but I don't track.
So you can, like, see out of it.
I will go around and find you the link.
Oh, my goodness.
But he sees out of it.
Yeah. But that's incredible.
And they grew it out of his tooth.
That's it.
You know, and it's like, I remember getting on online, and I think that, like, people my generation are kind of so steeped in the data interface aspect of life. I mean, my children obviously are going to be more so because they literally have grown up on a computer. But, you know, I got online in, what, 93, 94, something like that. Had computers from about 1983 on, because my dad was in computer science. But, you know, it's like I still get to watch how much it's changed things. I mean, you look at, like, the Twitter revolution in terms of the Middle East and mm-hmm. the uprisings. There's so much about the not just how we interface with data, but how that interface allows us to interface with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Skype, for instance, obviously.
Well, it's completely changed our world. The way the internet has evolved over the last, say, 20 years. You can't even... for people who are really young, you know, I teach, so sometimes I get people who are just out of high school. They don't even know what the world was like without the internet.
Yeah.
So I barely remember it because I grew up in the 90s, and that was about the time when things started really changing. You know, and then they invented this thing called the cell phone, and then that was weird.
Yeah,
it's actually, leads me to one of my other questions, though, because, you know, the thing about being able, there's that whole idea that we're in some ways more connected, at least on a broader scale, we're connected, but in other ways, we've become more isolated. And this was one of the things that I noticed about a lot of these stories is that you have really, really isolated characters. In some way, shape, or form, they're either separating from or trying to connect with something else. From Dora and Vacobox, which I loved that story. Maybe it's because I'm married, so any marriage stories kind of, you know, hit home. And I'm a stay-at-home mom, so that double the impact. And then Sean Marksman in Seeking Nothing with the clones. And obviously that title is a bit of a misnomer in a way. So what is it about isolation? Why do you think that, was that intended as a sort of theme between your stories, the isolation, or is it a theme in other of your stories as well, not just in this collection?
I think it's a theme of a lot of my stories. And I think it's because that's one of the questions that haunts us all, is kind of, who am I and how do I connect to the world and what can I expect from the world and how do I, you know, people enjoy connections, right? We're all sort of monkeys at heart and we enjoy having fellow primates around us, but it's not quite as possible as it used to be. And so we're still kind of trying to figure out how do we sort of figuratively pick fleas off the next person and enjoy that.
It's a really interesting analogy, by the way. I like it a lot. But you're right. You're right. And I think Jenna's pointing out something that's really interesting about a lot of your work. So many of your stories are about those kinds of people mm-hmm. that are trying to sort of find their place. And then sometimes really bad things happen to them. Or bad things happen to them, and then they become isolated, and then more bad things happen.
But I have to say that some seem to choose that isolation. Or mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. like what's her name, Belinda, in Surrogates.
Yeah.
Surrogates was an oddly disturbing story in the first place. But you have to read it, Sean, because it's fantastic. But she deliberately seems to separate herself from her husband, although the whole marriage ritual and part of the reason for the marriage was to get a new surrogate. So that in itself was an interesting sort of, you know, purposeful disconnection. But then she just cuts herself off from him completely.
She cuts herself off from him, but she also, I think of it more as her picking an alternate mode of existence. You know, because she's chosen to, and I don't want to spoil things too much, but the choice that she makes enables her to exist differently, if that makes sense. Yeah. And certainly, I mean, one of the questions is that a sort of false existence?
Right.
Or, you know, it makes her happy, so...
So it can't be that bad.
Just and because, I mean, I wrote it, so I would think it sounded kind of appealing to me that all these sort of odd things happen all the time.
Yeah. It's just for our listeners, she has something called an insanity chip that lets her see basically what she wants to see, but in a sort of odd, disconnected way. It's a very interesting. I was sitting there going, now it sounds like fun. I don't think to the extent that she did.
No, she went. She's a pretty extreme case. You can see the appeal of kind of periodic dips into the insanity chip.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Just every once in a while. Maybe when my kids are yelling about something. You know, it's one of those things. But, I mean, speaking of, you know, sort of the speculative nature of this, I mean, you have everything from obviously an insanity chip, which and surrogates, to living fur, which, again, that was a great story. And then your spider prostitutes, which was really fascinating. What makes you choose the things that you speculate on in your short stories?
Often my stories begin as a scene that will come to me. The mermaid story. The idea of the cannibalistic mermaids came early on, and then sort of collided with some other ideas. And with the spider prostitute, it was actually the idea of this sort of creature cut off from its own kind, trying to exist in a unfamiliar place, came to me first, and then I had to write the story of how it came to be there and what its presence meant. You know, I like to, you know, I read a lot of science, and I like to kind of puzzle and think about what things would be like. The real fur, I think, would be, I'm drawn to the real fur. I'm a very tactile person, and I think having a real fur would be really cool, because it would be very sort of warm and heavy and comforting.
I'm just a little creeped out. Like, speaking of a number of your stories, like the story I started with was the mermaid story, and I've already got a problem with the ocean, and I told you this, I think, in a message. I don't go in the ocean because there's too many things that could eat me, and that sounds like an awful death to me. And then you go off and you're like, oh yeah, mermaids, but it's not like mermaids, like, you know, like mythological mermaids, like on Stranger Tides or whatever. No, it's, we're going to genetically augment people, but it'll be like a dirty bomb of genetics, and that some dumbass is going to screw it up so that they become psychotic and they breed like rabbits and then they eat people like piranha. And I'm like, well, that's great. Now I have to worry about some crazy guy in his basement doing genetic experiments like the freaking human centipede, but it's going to be mermaids.
Oh my
and
God.
Then, yeah, that's, that story's made me slightly paranoid. Not really, but I did find it, you know, like there's, because I think about it and I think, like, you know, as you were saying, you look at science and I look at some of your stories and I go, you know what? That's actually not really that far off of what could happen like next year. You know, maybe the mermaids is a little far off, you know, like we're not going to genetically augment people into being half fish, half man. But, you know, like the data collecting, I don't see that as far off. Like that could happen next year and I don't even think anybody would be fazed by it.
It already essentially is happening, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, in this very specific, that's one of the things I think is so fascinating about some of your new future stories is they're really near future stories, and they're not like stories just like, well, here's a slightly extreme example of like, no, it's like this is like on our horizon in a kind of really disturbing way. And I don't know if you meant, like, when you sort of created these stories and you wrote them over the many years, if that was what you saw yourself, but it's certainly, I think, becomes very clear, maybe now particularly with the way things have probably changed just in the last 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm. that a lot of these things are they're really not that far off of what could be real, mm-hmm. that could happen. So yeah.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that science fiction writers have always done, is looked at what's sort of around the corner and tried to talk about it, and often sometimes acted as the canary in the coal mine. If you look at a lot of Heinlein's stuff, I mean, he was looking at what the social trends were and was saying, well, okay, if that happens, what's going to, you know, what's next down the line? And in some cases, horribly, horribly off, and in some, you know, pretty on the mark.
It's the pretty on the mark part that worries me about you.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, that, you know, to me, the science and the speculation about, real fur and multiple but alien
the real fur thing could happen. That's
okay. Yeah. No. I get that. Like, all of this is stuff that, like, yes, it could happen.
No, I'm not just saying. It could happen.
I want real fur.
It's
by
one
the
step
way.
Away.
Again, I want an insanity chip and real fur, and my life would be made.
Let me just put you. I just got to pause you. The real fur thing is not only likely to happen; it's technically already happened. There are people in this world who are having hair, animal fur, surgically implanted in their nether regions.
Yeah,
I kid you not.
But that's not like living fur. That doesn't count.
I'm saying we're not that far off. Like, sooner or later, they're just going to, like, transplant, like, leopard skin over the... Yeah.
Could you let me continue, please?
Sorry.
I wanted to say that these things are still in these stories. They're kind of secondary to the experiences of the characters. I mean,
that's
they're
true.
Yeah, they are part of it. They're kind of the backdrop, though. I mean, obviously, if you just even go with the mermaid story, the mermaids are like, they barely play in to what's happening with the main character, Nico. The more interesting technology in that one is actually the
Mary Magdalena,
Mary Magdalene. Magdalena, whatever. And
ship,
her relationship with it. But beyond that, her relationship with herself, you know, coming to mm-hmm. grips with her past experiences, is that what you really find compelling about the science, or is it things that do they go hand in hand?
I think, I mean, to me, good fiction talks about people,
right?
And it goes back to the idea that we're all primates, right? We're all very interested in what the other monkeys are doing and what their experience is like. And I could come up with a bajillion, maybe in theory, I could come up with a bajillion really cool ideas and put them in a story. But if there's not characters in there the reader can identify with or be interested in, then it's just a collection of kind of shiny, pretty fragments.
Yeah, and that makes sense too. I am focusing really on the technology, but a lot of this, pretty much every story, with the exception of the cyberpunk story, which doesn't have any central character per se, mm-hmm. but all of the stories, I mean, a lot of your characters are characters who are struggling with some kind of internal thing. I mean, I think of one of the titles, you have like the mermaid singing each to each, which is the one we've been discussing, in which the main character, I'm not going to ruin what's going on, but she has a particular past experience, which is related to what Jen brought up about the ship, that her relationship mm-hmm. with the ship is very complicated about what has happened to her in the past. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, say, where was it? Miss Liberty Gets a Haircut, which is possibly one of your more humorous stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in fact, one of the things that Miss Liberty struggles with is sexuality, and I don't think I'm ruining anything about that, but her own sort of place, not just sexuality, but even some sense about her own humanity, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And I find these really interesting, because I sometimes like to say that genre fiction, yes, it does have the shiny and the pretty things and the sense of wonder, as they say, but ultimately the best science fiction, or fantasy even sometimes too, is the stuff that tries to get is that those essential, complicated human experiences, those conflicts that we all can go through, even like I've never gone through anything like Miss Liberty, but I can understand her conflict.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I can sympathize with it. I can try to contextualize it within my own world. And I think that's something that genre fiction maybe uniquely is capable of doing. And I'm not sure if I'm articulating it well, but so someone just interrupt me and say something that sounds more intelligent than I just said.
Well, I think that's really right, because one of the things that I really love about speculative fiction is that the technology and the ideas can echo the emotional situation going on. One of my favorite examples of that is at one point we ran a story on Fantasy Magazine by Elena Gleason, and I believe the title was Vanished, but I'm not sure. But it was about a woman who was literally becoming invisible to her lover. You know, so you have the speculative element in the invisibility, but at the same time, it was very much about the relationship, you know, and what happens in a relationship when you become so familiar to the other person, you begin vanishing to them. And I think speculative fiction does that so beautifully and wonderfully sometimes, and that's kind of one of the really amazing stories. Often you look at it and you're like, oh, yes, of course, that's what that's a metaphor for. And it's so cool.
I agree.
You actually deal with that a little bit with, which story is it? And I can't remember the title now. The one with the Psy Corps. Which story is that?
It's Not Waving, Drowning.
Thank you. And that, again, you know, I think it shows you sort of that familiarity, you know, like, and that the kind of the fear of being of the familiarity, but only one-sided familiarity. It's a husband, wife, and he gains the ability to read her mind. And she's terrified of it. But not just that, but what the decision on his part said about their marriage, I think, too. Right. Wow, now I have to go read Vanishing. That sounds fascinating. But you do that a number of times in these stories. Well, at least when you're talking about the relationships between people. But I have to ask, because it popped up a couple times, at least in Near. I haven't seen it in Far yet, but I haven't quite finished it either. So maybe you have more writers. But you have a number of writers as your subject matter. Close Your Eyes. Amber is a children's writer. And I really wanted her to read her graphic novels, I have to say. Miss Liberty.
Is that cute? Yeah.
Yes. Cute. Yeah, adorable. Miss Liberty writes romance fiction, which was brilliant. I think that was an interesting exploration of, you know, her own issues with sexuality.
Yeah.
And then you have Johnny, who isn't quite a writer, but in a sense he is. He records memories, but then he also edits them and he puts them back into the world. So why writers? What makes writers so interesting enough to write about?
Well, I mean, besides the fact that it's kind of part of my daily existence, and I'm constantly dealing with writers or talking with writers or teaching writers or going out with my writing group. To me, the role of the artist is very interesting. And what an artist does in terms of drawing from their own life, what an artist, you know, the ethics of creating art, the implications of creating art, I think those are absolutely fascinating. And for a number of the characters, for Johnny, it's a thing that kind of saves him, right? And it is that sort of artistic sensibility that allows him to do the capturing of moments. You know, not just the fact that he's got all that memory, but he's also got a very particular kind of mind that lets him do that. And, you know, writers, you know, part of the problem with writers is writers love to pontificate about writing, you know, so I'm trying to kind of keep that in check, but because we will go on for hours about it. But it's a really interesting act, right? We're taking reality and we're trying to create a new one, or we're taking, you know, our lives and basically throwing it in a jumbo bag with a bunch of stuff from the thrift shop and pulling it out and kind of seeing what configurations come out.
Yeah, putting yourself under a microscope in a way, too.
Yeah.
It's actually a really common thing. You think it, you know, when you look at all the literature, like, writers show up a lot in literature. I think writers, no offense, Kat, I'm a writer, too, so... But I think we've got an embedded narcissism. Like, we're just obsessed.
We are horribly, horribly narcissistic.
We're just obsessed with ourselves, you know? We play the whole, like, oh, the writing life is toil, and it's so hard, and we're so lonely, and we're... And then, you know, then we write constantly about ourselves and our struggles, and then, yeah.
That actually would also explain the isolation aspect of all these stories, because, you know...
It would make sense, too, why writers... Because that's a very common theme in a lot of literature, and it would make sense for so many writers to be fascinated with the question of isolation, because they would, traditionally at least, writers are an isolated group, mm-hmm. self-isolated even. Falling apart now a little bit, though, because now with like Twitter and all the social networking and all of the ways mm-hmm. we can socialize, it's really like, you know, the only way you can be really not a part of some sort of community in a very specific sense is to be like Thomas Pynchon and just never go anywhere and just hide in a hole. I don't know where the hell that guy goes. Like, I don't even know. I don't think he exists. I think it's a computer.
I don't know. Good. A computer couldn't write what he writes.
That's true. Yeah. But, you have to literally disengage from the entire world to become that isolated. But still, there's that sense of isolation. With writing, you know.
Well, there's also, I think writers also engage in this weird sort of double consciousness where, you know, like every once in a while you'll find yourself in those moments where you're kind of internally dictating. She went to the sink. She picked up the dish. She did, you know, where you're kind of narrating your life, and hopefully you don't do it for too long because it's very distracting.
Did anybody watch Glee last night?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay. I won't ruin it for you, but Brittany has some fantastic voiceovers that aren't actually voiceovers.
Well, I she's one of my favorite characters.
That's hilarious. Sorry.
But, it is what we do. And it's a kind of one of the curses of being a writer in that, you know, you could be listening to a friend telling you, you know, terrible, horrible things that have happened to them, and part of you is kind of filing it away because, like, well, that'll make it for a good story. And then, you know, at the same time, also, when you're kind of undergoing shitty stuff, you know, there's a little part of your mind that stands back and goes, okay, well, at least it'll be material.
Can I ask you a silly question?
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever have, like, out loud conversations with your characters?
Not with my characters. I have out loud conversations with myself and with the cat.
Okay, then maybe I'm just weird. It's really weird. I'll have these moments where I pace around my house and I'll like talk
mm-hmm.
to nobody. I'll like give speeches. It's so narcissistic. I give speeches to things that I'm never going to attend.
Good job.
I don't know why I do it, but it's.
Have you accepted your Hugo Award already?
Yes.
We all do that, right? We've all got a little speech for the shower where you've won the triple crown of spec fic, right? You've gotten Hugo, the Nebula, and World Fantasy, right? And it's that last third speech, and you're kind of gently acknowledging the crowds.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay, let's move on.
So I have to ask something about Angry Rose's Lament, because I think it actually, not only does it deal with addiction, Paul Reder is the main character. And he was addicted to a substance called Stardrift that apparently mm-hmm. gives you this connection to everything. Right. He is a recovering addict, though, so he feels disconnected from everybody right now. And then he's given an opportunity mm-hmm. To kind of go back into a connected world. I think that's almost an interesting metaphor for that sort of writing process, or at least the newer writing process. I mean, you obviously, in order to even have material, you're going to have some sort of connection with the outside world.
Right.
Otherwise, I'm really not sure what you'd be writing.
Yeah, what would you write about?
Lots of
I'll think of something.
Go and just write makeup stories about people or something.
Right.
That's true,
but,
yeah.
But there's a process by which you have to disconnect yourself from it in order to give the outside perspective, to explore what's happening and whatnot. And then there's kind of that renewed, you know, desperate need, though, probably for most writers, like you isolate yourself, but that's not actually really a nice position to be in most of the time. Isolation is not fun for most people. No. I don't think I've ever met anybody who it is, except maybe the one character who likes her insanity chip. but you have to have that sort of, you have to reconnect, and there's a need for it. And it just occurred to me that's kind of what is happening in Angry Rose's Lament, which I didn't even realize was named Angry Rose's Lament until just now, even though she's kind of a side character.
Side character.
Huh. Interesting, Kat. Very interesting.
Hopefully this is where I make wise noises and go,
So what is it about addiction and support groups? You have a couple of stories that kind of have support groups in them.
Well, I have a parent who is alcoholic, and so that is one of the things that kind of growing up I thought about. And you know, families of alcoholics have their own kind of special connection issues. And that's why they have Al-Anon and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And it is something that, I try to explore the things that I think about. You know, I try to write about the things that are consuming me without being, you know, too obvious about it.
So do you find that you draw on a lot of sort of either personal experience or people you know who've had that experience? Like, when you write a lot of your fiction, I know this is again one of those silly questions, but I find that for myself, sometimes I don't draw on my personal experiences. I'm trying to write about experiences that I've never had. Do you find that you write in a lot of sense about experiences you've either had yourself or that people close to you have had?
I think I try to, if not draw on personal experience, at least draw on personal experience of emotion, I haven't known what it's like to ride a, you know, galactic skateboard across the stars, but I can remember driving very quickly and how much I enjoyed it. If that makes sense, you know,
yeah.
Drawing that way. And I think that ends up making, I think fiction that has some emotion behind it, even when it's painful emotion, ends up being better than some of the really, you know, superficial stories.
That makes sense, yeah. I should just let you know that I have actually surfed across the galaxy.
Yeah. In your mind?
No, I did it.
Okay, good for you.
It was 1999. There's a story behind it. Yeah. I may have been drunk. May have been. No, I wasn't drinking then, so I couldn't have been drunk. But I could have been injected with something.
We'll just believe you. We'll take your word for it.
Yeah, that was in my CIA days, so.
Your CIA days, when they were dropping you into Cambodia behind enemy lines.
Yeah, exactly, see?
In 99. It's sort of time loop.
Speaking of perfect segue, Jen, thank you. Well,
thank you, you're welcome.
You set that up perfectly. One of the stories that I found kind of disturbing, but in a really interesting way, was Peaches of Immortality. Mm-hmm. Which I'm calling a vampire story, but
no, you
even,
know what? It's Groundhog Day.
It is Groundhog Day, but I find it to be like a vampire story, not in the traditional sense of like a vampire, like a person who actually goes and sucks blood, but in the sense that I'm going to kind of ruin, I guess, for some people, but the characters who are our fantastic element, you learn that they relive their lives, but that they're not just reliving them. They're essentially like sucking the life out of other people's lives by doing all these changes and manipulating people and playing these kind of sick little games in the way that they're reliving it, et cetera, et cetera. And I was really interested, could you talk a bit about how you developed this idea of the kind of really dark nasty, sick side of immortality, but in a very different way of getting at that. Because usually, you know, when you think of immortality, it's like, oh, it's vampires, and like, they live forever, and they're kind of douches because they've been around forever. This case is like, no, these are people that are like reliving high school, which is stupid, for one. Mm-hmm. Why would you relive that? That's awful. But they're reliving it, and they're getting, I guess you get the impression that they get more and more kind of sadistic about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess, yeah, talk about that.
Okay. So, I mean, at the heart of it, that story is about one of those mental games that I suspect we all go through, which is that sort of what if. What if I had done X? What if I had bought Microsoft at a good price? Or, you know, what if I had chosen to go with person A rather than person B. And I think that urge is narcissistic, but is also it's one that we all sort of fall prey to, and it's I think a fruitless urge. I mean, it's one where if you know you spend so much time thinking about all of that you have no time to sort of live in the present. I think it is in many ways a sort of destructive way of thinking. That makes sense. I mean, that to me is what is at the heart of things.
That's depressing. I just really like that story, but if only because
story.
Yeah, but kind of, sort of. I don't know if I would say it's quite depressing. I think it's
kind of depressing. I feel bad for that guy.
The ending, they sort of things change at the end.
That's true.
I went to see Hot Tub Time Machine like 2 weeks after I finished that story, and I was like, "Oh fuck!" They've written it already.
No, they haven't written because Hot Tub Time Machine is. I liked that movie, but only because it was really dumb.
It essentially is Groundhog Day. I mean, you look at except that he's
it's Groundhog Day, but they choose.
Okay, no. Yeah,
sort of.
Cracked has this fascinating viewpoint. They have fascinating viewpoints on pretty much everything. But Cracked.com has this great bit on Groundhog Day. And they essentially say that, you know, Bill Murray has become a god by the end of it because he is able to use his knowledge. I mean, there's the conjecture that he's actually lived something like 10,000 or 100,000 years over the course of one day over and over and over again. Only because in order to become an expert in the number of things that he's become an expert in and the people, there's that idea that you need 10,000 hours to become an expert. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that he knows so much that he is able to manipulate the world in which that's essentially what he's trying to do, is manipulate it so that he can get out of it. By not screwing up his relationship with Andy McDowell.
Mm-hmm.
Is that her name? Whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not the character's name, but the actress.
Right. So, I mean, and that's kind of what's going on with Peaches of Immortality, except it sounds even more painful because they live their entire life over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of the characters, to get to restart their existence, have to die.
I know. Right. Is that how they restart? It almost seemed like their way out. It was the only way that they could. That one character, she seems like she doesn't want to be a part of this.
But the impression that I got was that it didn't really matter if she didn't want to be. She was stuck in this
system.
She was
stuck in it.
Because she made the choice to be a part of it at some point.
Right.
Which makes it even kind of more effed up. Like, there's no getting out now. You are a part of this. As I say, vampire narrative metaphors.
I think that works. I mean, I think it's a quite possible way to read it. I mean, and it's a horrible existence, right? I mean, that's why they're getting more and more sadistic, is they're getting bored.
Yeah.
They've kind of been there, done that.
Well, right. I mean, even the main character who doesn't realize, you know, at the start what's going on. I mean, he even says, like, you guys are really great as musicians. Why didn't you go off and become rock stars? And they say, we've done that. It was kind of lame.
Yeah.
Like, too many people, they hang out around you too much, just groupies, and, like, that's cool for about 8 hours, and then you realize, crap.
That's cool for maybe one lifetime. Yeah, you suck it.
Well, and, you know, it's like one of those, I think when you realize, when you get to the end of the story, it's like, trying to do it over and over, if you got the opportunity, you know, maybe doing it over once or twice would be fine.
mm-hmm.
in a kind of way. But at the same time, it also makes you realize, like, well, maybe you should just try to do the best you can with what you've got. Because then otherwise you could end up, like, if you could redo it over and over, you might get bored with the life, you know, mm-hmm. with knowing how life can go or being mm-hmm. or knowing how to manipulate life to get what you want.
That's mm-hmm. why the what if idea is such a trap. I mean, it's only because if you even if you keep doing it over and over again, there is no perfect version of anybody's life.
Mm-hmm, true.
It doesn't exist. I mean, because every single time you do that, you change something, you're going to be like, yeah, well, you know, what if you're going to have a new avenue of what ifs yeah. to go down. Yeah. And on none of them will you actually be happy. I'm just so like, go to a psychologist and talk to a counselor, something along those lines. You'll never be happy with your life if you're not happy with yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that's precisely we're like totally just digging into this story, but a lot of those characters, they're not even happy with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely mm-hmm. miserable in a lot of senses. And half the time, I'm not even sure they know who they are anymore. You think of the main guy who's in charge of it all now, who has the peaches in his little vault behind a painting, which is very stereotypical of him for being an evil genius. But he's completely disconnected from, and he's a sociopath. I mean, he, in the negative sense of the term, you know, he doesn't really give a crap. Like this has become a pure game for him. It's not about the relationships with people. Like he couldn't give a whatever, just whatever. It's all just about playing the game and. Doing it's like I don't even know how to describe it anyway other than that. And that's
well, I mean, these are yeah. people who are willing to take extreme, fairly extreme actions. They're willing to kill for their version of mm-hmm. life.
Yeah,
and then to them, they are the most important people, right? You know, and then it is a sort of classic definition of a sociopath. Is it's like I am the only person who really exists in the world.
Yeah. Messed up cat.
Thank you.
They're interesting story. I see. This is the thing: is like when people tell me science fiction needs to just be happier, and I go,
"No,
I don't even know what the hell that means." Because
yeah.
I like conflict, and
yeah, okay. So here's a question, Kat. What do you think is the happiest story out of this collection?
Zeppelin Follies.
Oh, I haven't read that one yet. Damn it.
Zeppelin Follies is my. I tried to write a screwball comedy.
Oh, yay.
It is significantly lighter.
I thought Miss Liberty was a quite...
I like Miss Liberty.
Miss Liberty, I think it's a really good story. I don't think I would necessarily call it a happy story, though.
Well, no, but it's a conflicting like story, but it's happy-ish. I mean, I find that the humor, the plays yeah. on all of the tropes of... pretty much comic books for the last, you know, bazillion years. You know, all of the, like, they fought the, like, the clones of themselves from another universe. And, like, just these kinds
those
of...
Those were hilarious, yes.
I thought those totally were funny. Agree. And it all kind of ends up good, sort of, in the end. I mean, you know, it's just got conflict. That doesn't make it a sad story. That just means...
No. It just
you know,
doesn't
not,
make it a happy story either. No, does it?
It's not Dora the Explorer. It's, you know...
But Zeppelin Follies is a love story. So it ends with a classic happy ending.
Oh, okay. Well,
at least there's one. Yay!
I
have to say, so one of the funniest things about Miss Liberty gets a haircut was that I am a now former City of Heroes player. And one of your first contact is Miss Liberty.
Uh-huh.
So I spent the entire story just, you know, imagining her with, you know, the perfectly wedged blonde hair.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, my God. It's like, it's in that sense, I was laughing the whole time that I was reading Miss Liberty Gets a Haircut.
That was one of the stories that I had a lot of fun writing it. And I think that shows through.
I think it does, too. Yeah.
It goes back to your role playing. You mentioned that it was, you know, based on champion characters. Which,
yeah. Yeah.
So
from a bajillion years ago.
I don't think anybody plays champions anymore, so it would have to be.
Oh,
I'm serious.
That's
I used to play champions.
I haven't seen any new superhero role RPGs. I mean, I haven't been keeping up because I'm not in the same area as my former tabletop group, but right. I still go into the game store every once in a while.
Yeah, I don't think There might be a couple, but nothing as clearly superhero as Champions. I think everybody switched over to City of Heroes and just started playing
a
video game instead.
Sad. But City of Heroes is down. Somebody was just telling me it's gone away.
Yeah, November 1st, I think, is the end date. This is totally unrelated. Sorry, listeners. But yeah, it is getting shut down by the NCSoft. And very sad for a lot of people who are very addicted to the game.
Are there not going to be any third-party servers open?
Currently, there is no plans to that effect. So there's a bunch of people that are trying to save it, obviously. I mean, it's been a very popular game for a long time. I don't even remember how many years it's been out now. But, you know, it's like it's one of the reasons that every so often, because I come back in once every year or two. I'll play for a few months, then I'll leave, and then I'll come back, play for a few months, leave, come back. But, you know, short stories that deal with, you know, that aspect of things. Like, you at one point have which story is it that mentions that somebody is a clerk in
Therapy Buddha.
Life.
They're like
Therapy
a second
Buddha.
Life. They're clerk in second.
Oh my god. Oh yeah, yeah.
I loved that. I think that was one of the things that you did so well with these stories is interjecting. I'm totally serious here. Interjecting very familiar elements into stories that take place in the future.
I mean, yeah, and that one's really interesting.
Most of these are not quite recognizable as day-to-day life, like as we know it now. They're definitely set in the future. But Therapy Buddha had a bunch of very retro references in it in the first place, but the second life.
But that was an interesting one because the rationale for why she needs to sit online as a digital version of her, of herself, but even just a digital avatar sitting in this store is because they wanted to have the experience, like the human element of the shop.
That's it.
Right. And it's like, that's so just fascinating to me because it's like, you know, you think of like music and how everyone's complained about the death of record stores. And that's pretty much true. Almost most record stores are gone. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, now we don't have that human experience of meeting the guy who just sits all day long listening to music, who knows his music. Well, in Second Life, you just pay somebody at minimum wage to sit in a room. Like, you're looking for music, here you go.
We talked about this last week with Sheena on our urban fantasy discussion, the whole, even though it was not quite related to urban fantasy at this point, but the idea that the reason that bookstores are nice is because you can go in and be like, hey, what am I supposed to read? What resembles this? And that doesn't exist quite anywhere near to the extent that it used to. Some cities still have some fantastic bookstores, but...
But I worked in bookstores all through high school and college, and that was the fun part of working there, was that people would come in and go, I liked this, what would you recommend? And you'd be like, let me load you up with this stuff that I love.
Yeah, well, I did that in the video store. It was my absolute obsession, being like, oh my god, you have to watch this movie. And I hadn't even seen that many movies, but it was still fun to be able to like plug what you love.
That's it. I mean, there's a real joy in that, and being able to find stuff that you just, you know, you like, and being able to say, oh, you guys will like this too.
It's really weird that's one of those, the, you know, bookstores, music stores, and movie stores, they're one of the few in which it's nobody's ever actually made an argument about why we don't have skilled labor for that. Like, why would – it doesn't make any sense. Why would you'd open a music store and you don't have people that listen to a lot of music? Mm-hmm. Why that doesn't make any sense to me. It's same thing with books, you know. Why would you hire somebody who doesn't read? But they do that. They'll hire people who don't even read.
Right.
Like, what universe is this an intelligent idea? Like, we're running a bookstore. Let's hire people who know nothing about books.
It's brilliant.
Sorry, I'm low.
I want them to run the cash register.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I could... A hamster could run a cash register. Sorry.
That's going to be another of Kat's stories.
Yeah, but like if you go to somewhere like Powell's in Portland, Oregon, it's this great independent bookstore, and they put people in the different sections who read that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you can go ask them, you know, and they may not know everything, but they know... if you say, I'm really interested in X, and they go, oh, okay, let's go try that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that, because if I have a question, I can ask it, but it drives me nuts.
Sorry,
chain stores destroying... Anyway, I'm sorry.
But that's why we have podcasts. We can, you know, hopefully they can hear them or not hear them. And we can say things like, Kat Rambo's collection is fantastic and you should go buy it.
Yeah, actually, you should. I totally agree with that.
That was totally not a false statement on my part. So, I don't normally, I mean, this is, was kind of interesting for us because Sean is normally he's the short fiction guy. I am not a big short fiction reader. I never have been. I don't know why, except for Ray Bradbury, oddly enough. That's how I got into science fiction in the first place, was through short stories, but then I kind of just stopped. But I'm finding more now that I'm older that I enjoy short stories more and more. Maybe my attention span has gone.
You can savor short stories in a way that you know, at least for me with novels, I rip through them pretty fast, and with short stories, I take longer.
It's interesting.
Yeah, and I had a question about that. Like, what is it that you thought is so valuable about short story? Or what is it about the short form that you like? Because it is one of those forms that is so unique in its own little sort of universe. It's so different from a novel. The kinds of stories you can tell with a short story are obviously very different. Mm-hmm. And yet the really good short stories, in which I think some of the best genre fiction stories I've read are in this collection. And I really do mean that. There are some damn good stories in here, some really good ones. So, and they do. They make you think. They make you, even me. Like I, jokingly, I say, you know, the mermaids. Like that's my funny moment where I say I'm terrified of mermaids now. But like other stories have made me think. Like the stories of dealing with the data and the memory are making me think about the way my world is structured. And even Miss Liberty, and this is one of those things I'm really fascinated in with sexuality, the issue of whether or not what is it that is human? Is Miss Liberty human? Is she other? Is she, what is she? I'm fascinated with those kinds of questions. So, but I guess what for you is like in the shortest sense of the term, like what is so interesting about the short form?
Well, the thing I like about the short form is that everything has to count. You know, every sentence has to be doing something. There's just no room to be vulgar. No room for farting around. You got to be kind of, you know, one of the things that I statement that I sort of swiped from Michael Swanwick and now use shamelessly in my classes is that you have to pick one antelope out of the herd and go after that antelope wholeheartedly, and you can't sort of be dodging around going, well, that one looks a little plumper, because then you will capture no antelopes. And to me, that's what short stories do. They go after one idea or one, you know, facet of human existence and say, okay, this is what this is about.
Makes sense. It's a good explanation. And what is it with your analogies and with animals?
I like animals. That's probably why.
Apes and antelope, like, it's very interesting that they're very animal-oriented, so.
I was just trying to find it, because I think that was the first sentence that really struck me as just a fascinating image. I think it came in Close Your Eyes when she was talking about, and this is in terms of, you know, how each sentence has to do something, and this is when I really got it. I'm trying to find it right now, but it was a sentence about an enemy in a battlefield hovering over her and being inexplicably, you know, tender.
Mm.
Oh, God, I wish I could find
that
damn
sentence. That's in Not Waving Drowning.
Oh, Not Waving Drowning. Thank you. It was such a strong image for me of the relationship between the two people. And I really kind of got at that point. I was like, oh, okay, that it's kind of summed up the entire experience for me. And I found that you had a lot of, I mean, that's, you have those sentences in most of your stories, the ones that just kind of parse everything down to a single image. Obviously there's more to the story than just that, but kind of the essence, can be explained with that. I totally thought it was Close Your Eyes, because it works for both stories, I think.
Yeah, it does.
Close Your Eyes was a fantastic one. And we should wrap this up, unfortunately.
Yeah. So
I've got close. Everybody go read it.
Yes, you should. But I got my quick five questions. So these are, you don't have to explain your answers. You just have to answer. So, all right. So we'll start with number one. Would you ride a mermaid or on the back of a robotic superhero shaped like Lady Liberty?
The robotic superhero.
Okay.
Yeah, mermaids kill people.
Well, she could change the future and make them nice. They could be like Disneyland mermaids.
Okay. Oh, yuck.
Okay.
I like the cannibals then.
All right. Wetware or self-aware robots? Or boats, excuse me. Self-aware boats, sorry.
Self-aware boats.
Okay. If you had to choose a book worthy of burning, which would it be?
Oh, my God.
Hey.
A book worthy of burning?
Yep.
Anything by Glenn Beck.
We actually discussed doing one of our torture media.
Oh, on the Overton window? Yeah, we might still do that. But anyway, moving on. If you were trapped in a perpetual time bubble in which you had to relive your life over and over again, what one thing would you do differently?
Oh, dear. I would play less Bejeweled Blitz.
That's awesome. All right. And then question number five. It's the year 2563.5, and you've just won the lottery. What will you do with yourself?
I will buy myself a real fur.
Yay. So you're good. That's awesome. So, all right. So that's it. So why don't you let people know where they can find you, if you've got convention appearances or if you've got a new stories coming out, that they could find any of that stuff. So,
well, I will be at the Baltimore Book Festival at the end of this month.
Ooh.
I will be at SteamCon here in Seattle in mid-October, and I will be at World Fantasy Convention at the end of October. And you can find the book on Amazon or from Hydra House. And I think that's about it.
Your website?
Oh, my website. I'm sorry. You can go to actually catrambo.com. We'll take you to it. And there is a lot of links to my fiction there. So if people are interested, there's plenty of it online.
Yeah.
So you can sample it first.
Or you just buy the book.
Or you can just buy the book. That's fine, too.
Buy it. I think you should buy it. Anyway.
Well, I agree, so, you know, I might be slightly biased. But, you know, hey, you guys have just been a blast, too. This is... been a lot of fun chatting with you, and your questions have just been amazing.
Oh. Well, thank you so much for coming
thank
on,
you.
Kat. And that's why we do the show. So we get to have interesting conversations with interesting people.
Yay.
I feel really happy inside.
About interesting books.
That's going to go to my ego. You've just set off a whole big problem now.
Oh, that's fine.
So thank you so much for talking with us and being on our show and putting up with how silly we are and all of that. We really appreciate it, and it's just awesome.
And awesome. Good luck with the book. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care, guys.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.